Okay, is this working? Okay, it's working. Well, good morning. I'm sorry about the handout. It's the teacher in me. I can't show up without a handout, but there won't be any exams, so we're all right today. My name's Reuben Bell. I discovered the new church in January of 1987, which actually has been a while now. And one of the first things I did was to come out here to this camp that summer, and I met a whole bunch of new church people. I think I treated her daughter who broke her collarbone and did all kinds of interesting things out here that summer. And subsequent to that, I decided to become a minister, which my family thought was odd, and I did. I went to the Swedenborg School of Religion for a while, and then I went down to the Academy of the New Church, to their seminary, and finished there, and I became a preacher. And they also turned me into a biology teacher when I was down there. And I'm a physician. That was the first thing I started out in life to do. And so I've done a little bit of everything. And I like it all. I think that's my problem. But I'm very happy to be here, and I'm happy to be invited to be here, because it's a wonderful place. And when I lived away, I missed coming here a long time, and now I'm back, and it feels very, very good. This is a wonderful place. It has a good feel to it, as I'm sure you know. And it's where people can come and just get acquainted, talk about the things of the church in a setting that just allows a free exchange. It's wonderful stuff. So thanks for inviting me, and it's nice to be here. Now, for the baby boomers in this audience, the title of this talk hopefully may sound familiar. You don't always get what you want. But for the real hardcore baby boomers among us, you'll know that the title isn't exactly right. The Rolling Stones said it a little differently. Mick Jagger, our old friend, said, "You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get what you want. But if you try sometimes, you might find you get what you need." Now, he had it pretty right, good old Mick. But for the sake of this lecture, I'm making the claim that, in fact, many people in this era of prosperity and self-gratification can and do indeed get what they want most of the time. And here are two questions that we need to explore in the hour to come. Are the things we want really the things we need? And the important question is, who decides? And worst of all, we need to answer that before we're done. Wants and needs are not always the same thing. I think we know that. Now, our topic for the camp this week is charity. We all know that. Come from the Latin word caritas, which means dearness or of high price. But in its transferred usage, it means affection, love, or esteem. So it's a very strange little word that we're using here, charity. An English dictionary, the English Oxford Dictionary, that was for Richard, defines charity as either voluntary giving of money or other help to those in need, or tolerance in judging others. Well, that's okay, but there's not much room there to expand. That's pretty much what you get from the Oxford English Dictionary. It's cut and dried. And worst of all, this is all that charity means to most of the people in the world. And no wonder the world is so screwed up. Charity is so much more than that. It's tremendously more than that. And I'm going to refer to Hunter, if I can call you Hunter, I'm going to refer to her talk during my talk because she did a perfect job of setting up a reference for me to use as I talk about charity. So thank you very much for that. Charity is so much more than that. There's her circles, the degrees of the neighbor. Simple, as I'm going to point out, simple doesn't always mean easy, but there it all is. Charity is so much more than just giving stuff to people. And at least we should know that, us here in this room. These are plain new church teachings that explain how charity is a far more splendid thing than just giving stuff to people. And very importantly, we come to find, if you don't watch out, you could do charity wrong. Think about that. Most people don't. Now, the new church gives us two unique perspectives on charity. First of all, it gives us specific doctrinal instruction regarding what charity really is and how we should go about doing charity, how it should be applied. The Word, the Bible, requires that you love your neighbor as yourself. It doesn't say how. The new revelation for the new church tells us how to go about that tricky business. Second, and not surprisingly, New Church teachings on charity are not the same as those found in other faith traditions, Christian or otherwise. They're deeper and they're wider, and they offer instructions for practical application. And that's what I love so much about the New Church. It's practical. Knowing stuff is great, but knowing how to do stuff is even greater. And that's what we find. Charity is not what most people assume it to be. In the New Jerusalem, charity becomes a powerful tool that requires knowledge and skill for proper use. And like any tool you might buy these days, the instructions, you know what they include? Warnings. Everything comes with warnings now. Even things that you would have trouble misusing come with warnings. And why? Well, if tools are misused, people can get hurt. I'll show you a couple of things I brought, if I can find them. Here is a Xerox from the instructions of my DeWalt angle grinder. Now, this grinder is wonderful. It goes about a million RPMs. You hold it in two hands. It has a grinding thing on the face of it, and you can just grind away with the thing. It's wonderful. It's dangerous. I have a scar on my arm from an old one of these from 1967 that's still there. What does it say? General safety instructions for all tools. Warning. Read and understand all instructions. That's important. Read them, understand them. Failure to follow all instructions listed below may result in electric shock, fire, and/or serious personal injury. Well, that's serious. Believe me, I cut a big hole in my arm with one of these once. It was unsafe, too. The handle had come off, and the boss put a big screw, or a big bolt in it where the handle had been, with nothing to hold on but a piece of metal, which when you're sweaty, starts spinning around, and that's exactly what happened. I hit a rivet, and spun around on me, ate my arm, tried to eat my stomach, and there I was. And I told him it was an unsafe tool, but he said to use it anyway. So I was hanging off of a ship at the time, so I unplugged it and dropped it, 250 feet of water. So that took care of that. And I said, I don't know, it just went overboard. I was a kid then. But the point is, tools are dangerous. They require safety warnings, and we're supposed to heed them. Down here it says personal safety. It says stay alert. I like that. Now imagine that we're talking about this system of doing charity as a tool. Stay alert. Watch what you're doing and use common sense when operating a power tool. Do not use tool when tired or under the influence of drugs or alcohol. That's a good idea for any tool. And then this is the same thing for my power planer. Now there's an idea. It's like a plane, but it has an electric motor in it. You can go to town with that. I have an old house, and the doors never fit. Every year, you got to plane them off. So my wife bought me a power planer. Now, this is a good thing, but dangerous, man. It's just a handheld jointer is what it is. So it says, same thing, same disclaimer exactly. Then it says, tool use and care. Do not force the tool. Think about that. Do not force it. Use the correct tool for your application. The correct tool will do the job better and safer at the rate for which it is designed. These are words of wisdom here. This is revelation of a sort. So, those are my safety warnings for two tools. Now, my grinder grinds very well, and my planer planes, and it does it very well. It makes those doors fit. But what does the power tool charity do? Because it's a power tool. Does something very important, and we shall see. I'll be building this lecture from three kind of foundational passages from three different sources, and those are in your handout there, labeled, You Don't Always Get What You Want. First one's from a book called The True Christian Religion, or True Christianity, as we've decided to call it for the future. Number 53 says, God is order itself, among other things. The second is from the Arcana Celestia, 8478. You get what you need, not what you want, in so many words. And incidentally, the underlining there are my own. That's just emphasis added, they say. Arcana Celestia 6481, which tells us that the divine providence looks to our eternal welfare and not the cares of the moment, which is what makes divine providence such a pesky thing, because we look for the cares of the moment, obviously. Okay, so there you are, three passages, and hopefully I'll weave this talk around those three. The plan is that they'll all come together to tell us what this tool is for, a little about how it works, and always an important question, what's in it for me? Because we need to know that. There should be something in it for us. Fair is fair. So we'll ask those questions. Let's start with one of my favorite passages, TCR 53, God is Order Itself. Now this little passage is tucked into a series of passages from Numbers 50 through 74 in the very first chapter of this very important book called God the Creator. We find that in this series of passages, we find an elegant philosophical argument, including two spiritual experiences that explain how divine order comes down into creation without breaking all those rules of freedom. Now, that's a tough job to do. Swedenborg does a beautiful job of it. That whole series is worth reading. How does divine order come into creation, create it, form it, and not be it? That's a tough job. Swedenborg is the only philosopher that has ever nailed that question very well. But our passage has to do with it in only a very general way. It says, since wisdom from love produces form, and the state and quality of this is dependent on the order in it, it follows that God is order itself, and therefore that He of Himself introduced order both into the universe and to every one of its parts. Now that's a heavy statement when you think about it. But God is order itself. That's what we need to start with. That's my foundational principle. Second, we need to talk about the goal of human experience. Okay? Whether people know it or not, is to find the kingdom of heaven on earth. Now people don't call it that. Most people don't know that's what they're doing, but they do know what they seek, and mostly what is that? Happiness in some form. We're all out there just walking around like Night of the Living Dead, seeking happiness in some form. We call it different things, we seek it in different ways, but bottom line, what are we after? Happiness. In fact, those theological writings for the new church say that's really what we ought to be seeking, and that's what we get ultimately in heaven. It's as simple as that. So, now some people find this happiness in the most disorderly of activities and things. Some don't. But the happiness we all seek is a common element of the human experience. We seek happiness in all that we do. Now, lots of people look for the kingdom of heaven in some form or another. Some find it. Some settle for less. They find some brand of happiness. But the best way we find in the teachings of our church is to let the Lord lead us there by means of this thing called the new will. Now, the new will, simply put, is the Lord working not so much in us as through us. There's a big difference there. People talk about the Lord dwelling in us. Well, that's okay, but I don't like that very well. I would rather the Lord be dwelling temporarily through me. And here's what I'm talking about. We talk about the word vessel. We use the word vessel a lot. Lord, make me a vessel, we pray. And we use this word a lot. Swedenborg uses the word a lot, especially in his pre-theological work. He's talking about vessels. But there's two kinds of vessels. Here's a really nice one that we heard this morning. There's a vessel. Lord, make me a vessel. No thanks. I don't want to be this kind of it. It makes a great noise. I don't want to be that kind of a vessel. That vessel, in and of itself, is a dead end. Things can come into it, but unless we pour it or something, they're going to stay there and stagnate. Here is a vessel. That is a pipe, or a fire hose, or an aorta, or something like it. That's the vessel I have in mind when I use the term vessel. Lord, make me a vessel means let your whatever it is come through me into Him. And that then is the work of the heaven, the kingdom of heaven on earth. So think of vessel, think of a pipe. These are good, but think of a pipe. Lord, make me an aorta is what we ought to be praying. And that makes sense. So, now notice I said, simply put, it's the Lord working through us. Now, simply put is one of the worst phrases you can ever hear in the theology business. Because simply put does not mean easily done. The Lord says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's simple, isn't it? Love your neighbor as yourself. What could be more simple? Cast your burden on the Lord and others. Simple. Okay? But they're the hardest things that we're called on to do. Sometimes I think the simpler it is, the harder it is to do. And we're really, really on the hook here because no one can go home and say, well, I screwed up, but I didn't understand it. You see, what's to not understand about loving the neighbor as yourself? So we have no excuses here. Simple, look out for simple, because simple is always hard to do. So, back to the Lord working through us. This then, what does it mean, the Lord working through us? It is turning the Lord loose on earth, but only through human agency that we provide. What's our goal? We want the Lord to be loose down here, doing all the good stuff that He does, right? But He won't do it. It requires human agency. Interestingly, He won't just come in and barge in and fix things. Wouldn't it be nice if He did? Things would be good, wouldn't they? Instead, what does He do? He stands at the door and knocks. Just stands at the door, keeps standing at the door. And short of human agency, you and me acting in freedom to invite Him into our world, He'll just keep standing there forever. That's the problem with the Lord. He wants us to be involved in the process. Now, it's an important process. What we do is very important. The Lord is omnipotent, right? He doesn't do anything until we decide He's going to do it. Whoa, don't we have power? Don't we have power even over the Lord? Or so it seems. Because we have to decide when we want Him in. He does the work. We decide. Imagine that. Imagine the times that we don't decide. Knock, knock, knock. That's all we get. Okay, so what does this produce? If we do decide and the Lord comes into the world, steaming through that vessel that you have become, that we have all become, what do we get? Order. That's the whole deal. I love order. My children think I love it a little much. But I love order. Because without order, we have what? Chaos, all right? The order of heaven come down to earth. God is order itself, remember? How important is order in this world? Well, you're on vacation, but have you read a newspaper this week? Any newspaper, any week? Take a look at what the world looks like without order. That's how important order really is. The right kind of order. Heavenly order. The order that is God itself. Not the order imposed on people by other people. That's bad order. We want order from the Lord Himself. Is it important? Sure. It has to do, as Hunter pointed out, with how we treat one another. It's simple. How does it work? It's another one of those simple things, so look out. But it really has to do with how we treat each other. Now, the second passage in that handout talks about, said that for those who trust in the divine, all things are moving towards a happy state to eternity. I love this passage. And that no matter what happens at any time to them, it contributes to that state. You know, I don't think I have ever been able to actually do what it says here, to actually feel that way. Some days better than others. No matter what happens to me, I step on a nail, I fall off the porch, and yet I'm thinking, hey, no problem. This is contributing to my eternal welfare. It's hard to see, isn't it? Some days we do better than others. In other words, the divine providence looks to our eternal welfare and not the cares of the moment. Now, we are short-sighted as humans. Why? Well, we have natural eyes. We live in a natural world. And even though we have rational minds, we don't use them very well. And that upper part of our rational mind is pretty much just goes unused. We could learn to use it, but we don't much. So what do we see in this world? We see only the things right in front of us. I'm nearsighted. Without my glasses, I'm good to about, I don't know, now that I'm farsighted, actually, I'm pretty good out there. But I'm no good to the front row. People get blurry. By the middle and the back, you guys are just out there. You're just blurry faces. Now, you're good. But our natural eyes are short-sighted. I can only see what I need right now. Yeah, I can make plans for the future, but I really am interested in now, now, now. And that's the way we work. We are short-sighted or nearsighted. And why is that? Well, if we could see down the line to where providence is taking us, you know what Swedenborg says? Well, we would screw it up. We would say, oh no, I'm sorry, providence. I know you're wise and all, but really, I know what I need, and so that's not going to work. And so I would try my best to thwart the stream of providence. I would get out of it, and I would mess up my life far worse than I do on my own in my short-sighted state. We need to see providence in the back, but not in the face. So we are designed nearsighted, spiritually nearsighted. That's fine. So what are we supposed to learn from this? Well, this has to do with how the Lord, in His providence, treats every one of us. If providence only looks to our eternal welfare and the little moment-to-moment things, some of them are good, incidentally, but some of them aren't so good. A lot of them are unplanned. If all of those things are basically put there in some grand providential scheme by the Lord who looks to our eternal welfare, doesn't always give us what we want, then this gives us our insight into how the Lord treats us. You want to know how to treat your neighbor? Well, let's back up and ask, well, how does the Lord treat me? That's where we'll learn. That's a good idea. So it has to do with how the Lord treats us. So here's the key to how we treat one another. If you want to practice charity properly, if you want to use this tool according to the instructions and the safety warnings, then we try to treat the people as the Lord treats us. That's simple, isn't it? Well, there we go again. Is it easy? No. Anytime it's simple, look out. It's very, very difficult to do. Why? It means we have to do some choosing. The Lord chooses, doesn't He? So now if we're going to treat people like the Lord treats us, we really have to think of their eternal welfare best we can, or their overall welfare, and we realize that what they want may not be what they really need, and so there we are, we're asked to choose. And choosing, and Hunter really did a good job of using these different words. Choosing to some people is judging. Well, she didn't like that word because judging is what the Lord does. I'm for that. So we have to discern, and discern was the word I was going to slip in here. We have to discern. But you know, choosing is good too. So I thought about it while she was talking. I don't want to erase her circles. We have three levels, and I thought, you know, everything comes in threes, three levels, celestial, spiritual, natural, or however you want to break that down. Judging is good, but I believe the Lord does that. He can do it. Why? He's beyond time and space. He can see my now, my past, and my future, so that puts Him in a good perspective to judge. I can't do that, so we have to discern. Discerning is good, but discerning is a rational act. It's a thing my mind does in its highest aspect. Discerning, I like that. But I'm thinking the next level down is what I really have to do, and that's to pick and choose. I really have to look at people, and I have to pick and choose the actual things that they actually want or actually are doing, or what I actually am going to do for them, or not. So think of that as three levels of the same thing. My job is to pick and choose. I'm required to do that. Choosing is anything you want to call it, but it is definitely something we are required to do in these teachings for the new church on charity. You see, ignorance is bliss. Here's a little book. Hers was blue, mine's brown, different translation. And hers was from Swedenborg Society. This is from Swedenborg Foundation. Note the same smallness of the book. This is one of those sleepers. There is more good stuff in here than 20 volumes elsewhere. And this business of the degree of the neighbor, huge, all in this little book, which really isn't even a finished book. Swedenborg left it laying around when he died. Now, in this book is all these things we need to know about how to do charity. Now, before I read this book, I was blissfully ignorant of how charity works. I can just do whatever I like. If it felt good, it was probably charity. Oh, if it felt good to me, incidentally, not the poor person I helped. All right, so I read the book, Ignorance is Bliss. With this little book, the bliss is gone, and the work begins. This is a workbook. Sorry. It tells us how to do charity. The trouble is, charity is hard to do. It takes work, skill, and there you are. So now I'm no longer blissfully ignorant, and I have work to do. Great. Every time you read one of these writings, or books from the writings for the new church, there you are. Less bliss, more work. But the goal is bliss in heaven. We'll get that. So just, you got to do it on faith. Now, so the bliss is gone, the work begins, and here is a passage then about how we must carefully, and I use the word prescribe, because I prescribe all the time. I prescribed about 50 times yesterday. Well, 20 anyway. We have to prescribe our treatment for the patient. That's what I do. In order to do that, I've got to know the patient. I've got to know what they need, not what they want. Patient comes in and says, I want the thing on TV, you know, that purple pill. Well, yeah, but you don't need that. What you really need is this. Why? I know this because I know. So I'll prescribe something you need. Now, here at charity number 90, the human being is charity's subject. And the charity in the person is determined by what sort of subject the person is. Whoa, what sort of person are you? I have to try to decide that by some kind of choosing or discerning or something. It also determines what charity the person will exercise toward the neighbor. So really, what I want to know about you, need to know, has to do with the prescription that I'm going to write. That's very important stuff. And it's hard stuff. You know, we don't like choosing and picking and judging and discerning, do we? We'd rather not. So, if you don't pick and choose, and select, if you don't pick and choose, and if we don't do a little discerning in selecting charity, what kind of charity will we perform? And numbers 50 through 52 in this same little book really tell us pretty clearly what we're talking about. I'm going to read a little bit of it. Failing to distinguish the neighbor according to the quality of good and truth in the person, we shall be misled over and over. You're going to recognize this because she read it earlier. It's a different translation. Charity will be confused and finally be nullified. A devilish person may cry, "I'm the neighbor, do good to me." If you do good to such a person, that person might kill you and others. You're putting a knife or sword in the devilish person's hand. Naive people do this. It didn't say bad people did it. Evil people? No. Dopes? No. It just said naive people do this. They say that all are equally the neighbor, and also that it is not up to them to try to discover what another's quality is. God looks to that. I must simply help the neighbor. But this is not loving the neighbor. When we love the neighbor out of genuine charity, we ask what a person is like and then give benefits discreetly according to the quality of the person's good. So we have to pick and choose. Will we do it right every time? No. Will we screw it up sometimes? Yes. That's the problem. We don't want to take a step. It might be the wrong step. There's the book. If you're going to do it by the book, it says you have to do it. If I pick up my grinder, am I going to cut my arm again? Well, I hope not, but I'm going to use my grinder because I'm not through with the job. I just started with my grinder, all right? So I'm going to be careful and use a safe grinder this time, but it won't stop me from moving forward with my tool. The work needs to be done. So, charity, 50 through 52, good passages. That is charity by prescription. That's my terms. And that requires discernment or picking and choosing in order to write the prescription. Something we really don't like to do. But do it we must, or people will get hurt. We can misapply charity just like I can misuse my grinder. Remember those safe general safety rules. Failure to do safe charity has a name. It's called false charity, and it's the cause of much misery in the world. That's a topic unto itself. Imagine how much misery in the world at any given time comes about by false notions of what is good for the neighbor. My goodness, a lot. So, good enough. This leads us to our final passage that explains what it's like. It explains what it is that the divine providence gives you. You don't always get what you want. Now let's look again at the handout. It's based on the internal sense of Matthew 6:34. They're talking about the care for tomorrow. Do not worry about tomorrow, the Lord said. All right, it's based on that. Do not be anxious about the morrow, for the morrow will take care of the things belonging to it. Another one of those very simple admonitions. The Lord says, don't worry about tomorrow. So what am I doing? I'm worrying about tomorrow. I have a class to give. I have 2 hours of lecture. I'm not finished yet with the preparation. I have 11 facilitators, one of whom is sick, and I'm going to have a replacement. And that's just till noon. So I'm sitting here. I got a little tomorrow wheel turning in my head that won't turn off. Well, I'll get it done. I always do. I'm last minute Louie is my name. But the point is, I can't always quit worrying about tomorrow. It's so simple. The Lord said to do it. Why can't I just do it? Well, I'm human. That's why. That's my excuse. Okay, so they're talking about that. Don't worry about tomorrow. It's that short-sighted thing again. Here's how we are inclined to address the Lord in matters of providence. Now tell me if you do this. I know I do. We say, hey, Lord, I know what I need. I'm down here on the ground, you know. I can see what needs to be done right here, right now. I'm involved in all this stuff. If I can just do this, this, and this, things will work out beautifully. So if you don't mind, if you couldn't just get Providence to scoot in here a little bit and just support that, because I'm the one that knows. You see, I'm really involved in this. Does that sound familiar? I hope I'm not the only one here that does that. We all do that. And what Providence really has for us sometimes is something that looks very different. I'm thinking, Providence is here to help me, not to mess up my game here. And that's what it sounds like so often. So when we talk to the Lord this way and say, Lord, do what I need, because I want, because I know what it is, probably better than you do because you're busy doing lots of other things. I'm taking care of this. Does the Lord listen to us when we talk to him that way? Well, of course, I think he loves to listen to us. And we are talking to him, even if we're talking foolishly. And I think he just sort of says, la, 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 I can't hear you until you ask the right stuff. I'm not tuning you out. It's just like, okay, when I hear the right stuff, then we'll communicate. And I think that's what he does. He loves us talking to him. But we have to do it until we get it right. And what is right? Well, here's the way it works. He knows what is needed to bring us into order. Here, we're back to order again. We don't, obviously. And he gives us that thing, or that series of things. He knows what it is. Only we most often refuse to see it that way. Remember the person in that passage who trusts in the divine, that all things are moving towards a happy state to eternity, so that no matter what happens at any time to him or her, it contributes to that state. Remember that person? That person knows that. I know what I really want, but looks like I'm getting what I need, so I'm going to be happy here and just go with it. That with it, or it, is the stream of providence. There are people who do that better than others. And actually, I do that better now than I did 20 years ago, so I am making progress. I finally learned the hard way some things just don't work. But still, I buck it because sometimes I don't like it. It's hard to do. And so if it's hard to do, I guess it's simple, isn't it? Sure enough, it is. Go with the flow. The flow is coming from somewhere else, and the flow is designed for you. Hard to do. And from our model of how to treat each other, to bring people and situations and relationships into order, we must know what people need, and I mean really need, and give them that, sometimes whether they want it or not. The model here that comes to my mind is children. They know what they want, I know what they need, and as long as they're small, I can enforce that on them as a loving parent. They may not see it that way. Anybody have that experience? Good gosh, yes. And yet, what's coming is order, heavenly order, hopefully, from me to them. And so it's a good thing. But the trick is, or the operative phrase is, whether they want it or not. Sometimes doing charity to someone is not what they wanted. In this little book, it talks about people putting a person in jail can be an act of charity. For us, for the person in jail. Gosh, the person in jail doesn't always see it that way. But that's what it says. So this is where the new church departs from so many other faith traditions. We have clear teachings, deep and wide, based on spiritual principles that look to order, salvation, and a person's eternal welfare, not just feeling good in the moment. This is such a much larger doctrine. Charity, as I've said, is a tool. And tools don't just make noise and raise a lot of dust. If that's part of the fun of tools, they make a lot of noise and they raise dust. Tools also fix things. That's the whole idea of tools. They change things, often for the better. That's the whole idea. When I'm using my planer, the idea is to make the door shut. That's good. That's a positive thing. I'm bringing order to my room in a strange sort of way. So that's what tools do. They fix things. Keep that in mind. They don't just make you feel good and then you go away. They're designed to fix things. However, just as with any tool, how the job turns out is really up to me, isn't it? I know the tool. I know how to use the tool. I've read the safety instructions. I'm going to use the tool now. You know that electric planer, the power planer? If you're not careful, you'll eat most of the door off, and you'll have a door with a big gap, and it looks stupid, and your wife will never let you hear the end of it. So look at that door over there. Mr. Power Planer got busy on that one, and it'll never be the same. To which I always say, but it will never stick again either. So I have a couple of doors like that. Get a little carried away. So how the job turns out really is up to me, isn't it? Well, great. There's not one of those burdens I have to bear when I'm going to use the tool charity. If this works, I'll like it. If it doesn't work, hey, it was my doing. And there again, we hesitate sometimes to intervene in true charity because we're afraid to screw it up. Well, that's the same way with any job. I got in my car and drove here today. I didn't hesitate, but I could have had a wreck. The car could have died. Bad things could have happened. A meteorite could have hit me on the way, but I said, I'm coming anyway. You've got to do the same with anything else that you do. You just got to forge ahead knowing how to do it. Right. Now, if you've been listening, and I hope you have been, you've probably found the weak link in this chain, the fly in the ointment of my logical progression. Now, what is that weak link? Well, the Lord knows what we want even when we do not, because, well, he's omnipotent, omniscient, omnipresent, it says, all those omnis, okay? What about us? Okay, before we can give people what they need, we have to know what that is. I've already talked about this. We have to discern. We have to pick and choose, okay? And I'm not a very good judge. We all say, who am I to judge? Well, there's some true humility in that. Who am I to judge somebody? I've got flaws like crazy. So I'm going to stand up like a Pharisee and judge you and say, here's what you really need. Okay, that's a problem. Well, who am I to judge? I, for one, am not any of those omnis, and I know that. So how can I know what you really need? That's the weak link in the chain, because that argument is a strong one, which leads us to the home stretch here. How do we know? How do we know? Well, we have to find out. And we have to find out right. And we're going to mess things up. So where do we go? We don't go to Dr. Phil or Dr. Laura or Oprah. We go and ask the Lord, because we can't miss when we do that. He always knew that we wouldn't know stuff like this innately. So over the centuries, he has given us his divine truth, accommodated, and that means kind of dumbed down, to our own understanding, because that's what accommodation really means. And that dumbed down form of pure divine truth is called revelation, and we have that. It's not a new idea, but some of it is newer than others. Revelation comes in different varieties. We've got the ancient word, we're told, the first 12 chapters of Genesis predates history, written in pure correspondences from the ancient church. Wonderful idea. We have the Jewish word, or the Old Testament, that spans a period from somewhere around 4,000 years to 2,000 years ago. That's old revelation. Still, dumbed down to fit the people of the time. Then we have the Christian word, or the New Testament, which starts roughly 2,000 years ago. We got it. And then we have the revelation of the new church, which is a whole different kind of revelation. And the ink is barely dry on that, 250 years or so. So we have revelation. We have the Lord telling us what we need to know if we're able to get in there and find it. Now, each is its own kind of revelation, and each is accommodated to the people of the time in which it appeared. And as people's ability to process spiritual reality changes, and it does over time, so does the nature of the Lord's revelation change to fit those abilities. It's evolutionary, if you get right down to it. I have a friend who's a PhD in psychology. He's a cognitive psychologist. I'm trying to bend him toward not being so agnostic. But I said, he teaches evolutionary psychology. I said, well, what about evolutionary spirituality? So I've got him interested, and we're going from there. He's a patient of mine, so anytime he comes in, I take about 45 minutes with his patient. They think I'm doing all kinds of things with this guy. We're just sitting in there talking philosophy. So we have the information. It comes in different forms of revelation. All told, it's a lot of revelation. All right, it's the Old Testament, the New Testament, 30 volumes in the Standard Edition of the teachings for the new church. That's a lot of revelation. Okay, problem. What if we don't agree on the details of this revelation? Because remember I told you it was dumbed down to suit our understanding, which is apparently pretty dim from the Lord's point of view. No offense, but he says, you know, you guys, I don't know. I'm just going to have to make it the best we can so you can understand it. What if we don't agree on the details? You suppose that's possible? Of course, we don't ever agree on the details. So what goes on here? If we don't agree on the details of revelation and what they mean, what will we do? I know. Let's look to Revelation and see what it says. Maybe it can help. And here are a couple of great ideas. In fact, these ideas are simple, so look out. See the other handout. Why can't we all just get along? Who was the guy that said that? Rodney King? Why can't we all just get along? Okay, number 3551 from the Arcana Celestia. Wonderful passage. I could find you 10 more just like it. That says, but at the bottom, and I want you to read the whole passage, but dissent in matters of doctrine, that's when we don't agree on the details of this revelation concerning faith, does not mean that the church cannot be one church, provided all are of one mind in willing what is good and doing it. Whoa, one church, imagine that. That'll never fly. No one likes that idea. It's too radical. Then AC 1834 comes along. It's one of my favorites. It's kind of one of those yes, but passages. It's a good one. In the course of time, they're talking about what happened when charity fades in a church. Church meaning a great period of time in these churches as they move through history. Charity fades, passes away, evils took its place, and on and on. From this came schisms and heresies. Oh my goodness. And they would never have existed if charity had continued to reign and live. In those days, they would not even call it schism or heresy, but a matter of doctrine or a detail adhered to in accordance with a particular belief. That matter of doctrine they would leave to each other's conscience, provided it did not deny anything fundamental. That is, here's the good part, the Lord, eternal life, or the Word, and provided it does not contrary to divine order, that is, the Ten Commandments. So, here are some guidelines for those of us who like rules. I'm a rule guy. I like this. I love this passage. But these rules look like rules we could all live with, don't they? As we go about this business of charity. These aren't hard rules. Trouble is they're simple. There we go again. So, where are the teachings on charity? I want to just briefly mention that there are lots more than this little book. Where are the directions with the general safety instructions for all tools? Well, the one we talked about is this one, a little book called Charity. That's the one we use most often. There is also a chapter, whoa, I'm dropping everything, in the True Christian Religion on charity. We forget that. It's a wonderful chapter. It's written differently, talks about the same stuff from a whole different perspective. That's where we learn about charity, and it's a wonderful chapter. Like I said, we forget it's even there sometimes. And ta-da, in the Arcana Celestia, there's a whole book on charity, whole separate book on charity. It's in that material between chapters, kind of like advertisements between chapters, these major chapters in the Arcana Celestia, in volume 9, dealing with charity. Unbelievable. And I extracted all these passages one time. No one has ever done it. Usually one of the foundations or somebody will extract that and publish it as a little book. As far as I know, it's never been done. Passages on charity from the Arcana Celestia. I broke it into an 11-week course of study, and I didn't, you know, like I said, I love order and things, and I'm a teacher. But the fact is there are three major sources on charity: True Christian Religion, the book Charity, and in Arcana Celestia, Volume 9. So there you are. And they're all good books on charity. So we have plenty of stuff, plenty of teachings, and it's good news straight from heaven, as Johnny Appleseed used to say. This is the straight stuff on charity. So there you are. I have to stop. We have an instruction book on how to practice charity. Well, we have three, but I'd call it one. Put them all together. What an instruction book for practicing charity, complete with warnings and how to use it properly. It is from the Lord Himself, so it must be good. Practical teachings for the New Jerusalem. It is important, used improperly, this powerful tool could cause great harm. And perhaps worse than that, it could prevent great good. Because when you don't do charity, nothing happens. Remember that. We can disagree on the finer points of these teachings. I don't have any problem with that myself. We love to disagree, though, don't we? And we love to split into factions, and we love to fight, and we love to do all that stuff. But we just read two passages saying, you know, we don't need to do that. It's from the Lord Himself, incidentally. So we can disagree on the finer points, as long as we remember the really important things, which is the nature of the Lord, eternal life, the Word, or Bible, divine order. And what is divine order? Well, it's it's epitomized in the Ten Commandments. Those are easy ones. And that brings us to the last big question, because I'm almost done. A grinder grinds, and a planer planes. So what does charity do? It's a tool, you know. Well, it brings order into a disorderly world. That's what it's for. What kind of order? We already know. Divine order, which is, we know, God itself, Himself, come down to earth. Can we see this order? Yes. It is the fabric of society. We see it. How do we see it? We notice it most often when it begins to unravel. And it's unraveling a little bit in our own day, isn't it? That's how we see it. When charity works, that fabric gets tighter. Who makes that fabric tighter? Well, you don't. The Lord does. But how does the Lord get there to do it? Whoops, my tube went away. He flows there through you into it. You must select to do charity. You must do it properly. And when you do, that fabric of society tightens and tightens and tightens until it is truly the Lord's heavenly kingdom on earth. We invite the Lord in to do the work. He is standing there, waiting and knocking. Not in us, but through us, when we treat our neighbors with charity. Not from just any old inclination to do good, whatever good is, but when we do charity by the book. And last of all, what's in it for me? Because I always ask that. Fair is fair. If I'm going to do all this work, what do I get out of it? You get the kingdom of heaven right here on earth. And that's a promise. Thank you. Yes. Want this on during the questions? Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Ran over. Sorry about that. I'll answer you later. Okay, good, thanks. I didn't have a mic.